So we're carrying on with these medieval traditions. We've looked at the religions of Vishnu briefly, and the next two or perhaps three sessions we're going to be looking at the religions of Shiva. And you've got a handout, two-sided handouts. One is a text in the Pashupata Sutra, which we'll be looking at later on. And there's for Sanskrit wallers, there's a Sanskrit on the other side of it. And the other is a more or less a summary of what I'm going to be showing on the PowerPoints. So you don't have to take notes or anything if you don't want to. So if you remember, way back, the origins of Indian theism, this is a kind of recap really, were in the Upanishads. And you have this idea developing of a god distinct from the universe, which is theism. And the key text here is the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, which is equivalent in the sense, so the Bhagavad Gita is not equivalent in the sense that it's a fame, but it's a theistic Upanishad, and it's a kind of Shaiva version, I suppose, perhaps, of the Vaishnava Bhagavad Gita. But it's focused on Rudra, Rudra, who's an early form of Shiva. And in this text, it's a very interesting text. You get the idea of God creates, maintains, and destroys the universe. And also you get yoga in there, and God is Mayin, the producer of Maya. Maya in the text. It gets translated as illusion, but I suppose that's a fair rendering. Maya, sort of like a material, it's a material substance out of which the universe is produced. But it's unreal compared to God. But I don't think in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad it means illusion in the sense that it does in the later Vedanta tradition. And the god is Mayin, the magician, the one who creates or weaves the universe. As a spider weaves a web, so the Lord may manifest the universe. We're just having a recap. So the god in there is Mayin. Shiva, Rudra, is the Mayin. So from fairly lowly origins in the Rig Veda, where there's a couple of hymns to Rudra, who's a ferocious god on the edges of society, who you make offerings to keep him away from your children and your cattle so he doesn't take them. He becomes a much more dominant deity later on. So he's a roarer, and he's got a red back. right, next one. Oh, here we are. Yeah. So from the 500 BC to about the first millennium, you get the growth of sectarian worship of particular gods. Sacrifice, yajna, gives way to bhakti devotion and devotional worship, puja. Now the word bhakti and guru occur in the last verse of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, and it talks about grace, prasada. But that's the earliest occurrence. My view is that it's actually a much later interpolation of that verse into the text, because it's the last verse in the text. And it's the only mention of bhakti or prasada in the Upanishads. So I imagine it's a later interpolation. But anyway, it is there. And you get bhakti devotion to a personal god, Bhagavat or Bhagavan in the subject case, or a goddess, Bhagavati. So the Bhagavad Gita comes from that word Lord, song of the Lord, song of God, Bhagavat.
Sorry, bhakti was what? When you say to a person, was that an impersonal god then?
No, bhakti is to a... Bhagavat is a...
Oh, I see.
Is a kind of theos, like a...
Yeah.
Described as Purushottama. Whatever that means, personal god, I don't think Vishnu is a person in the sense that you and I are persons.
No.
Strange sort of person, really.
Can relate to.
Yeah.
Commune
with. Who's got qualities, I think that's what it means, really. Saguna. And then in the historical development, we've got this process of Sanskritization where local traditions get absorbed into this large Brahmanical Sanskritic machine or juggernaut or something, and it gets absorbed into it. And it was what Sheldon Pollock's called A Sanskrit Cosmopolis. It's a very interesting book that you should perhaps be interested in looking at, called The Language of the Gods in the World of Men. I think it's got another title, actually. I don't remember. And there's actually an article that he wrote called The Sanskrit Cosmopolis, whose reference will be in that book, which is a good short, much shorter summary of the argument, really, although it does occur in that book, which has become a very thick book. But he argues that this like a bit like Latin in medieval Europe, there was this Sanskrit was the common language from Kashmir, Afghanistan, all the way down through India to Southeast Asia, even. So you get this Sanskrit cosmopolis spreading out, which was adopted by the local kings, and was the language of scholarship, the language of learning, the language of ritual, and the language that people from different parts of this vast continent could relate to each other through. So it wasn't related to an empire, but it was a kind of intellectual empire, I suppose, what you call the Sanskrit cosmopolis. And at this time, you also get the assimilation of the ascetic ideal into high caste household ideology, as we get in the Bhagavad Gita. And also the assimilation of the ascetic ideal into low caste possession cults, such as the Tayams, later on that we'll be looking at. So these ascetics who are living on the edges of society, their ideas and ideologies get absorbed into mainstream Brahmanical religion. So you can be an ascetic and you can be a householder as well. You can do your duty and you can be a renouncer, says the Bhagavad Gita. And this is all linked in with the segmentary Hindu state that Burton Stein speaks about. That it wasn't like the Roman Empire, where you have like the Guptas weren't like a Roman, where you have a centralized bureaucracy governing a large area. It was more that you have local rulers paying ritual obeisance to another, and taxes probably to a higher ruler. And the Guptas were at the top of that tree, if you like, that's spread out. So you get inside of a segmentary state. For example, in the I think it's 14th century Vijayanagara, you get at Hampi, if anyone's been there, you get that. It's a very tall tower, and the king used to sit at the top, and everyone once a year will come and pay homage to him. And the Shakti, the energy of the goddess, would go down into him from, I don't know, from the sky or something, and then he would generate his power out to the people. And you get patronage of different groups, different religions are all vying for patronage of these kings. That's how they survive, they get patronage. So the Shaivas get patronage, and then the other religions tend to copy the Shaivas in this medieval period in order to, one view would be to get patronage. And then you get these complex narrative traditions developing, the Puranas. There's a problem, there's lack of historiography in South Asia. There are some texts, like there's Kalhana's Rajatarangini, the account of the kings of Kashmir, which is a bit like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle or something like that. But you don't get much historiography. And it's interesting why you don't. Well, it's an interesting question. But you get the development of mythical narratives, and what we would call mythical narratives, such as the epics and the Puranas. And the Puranas are the lineages of kings. And you get during this period the rise of the gods Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess Devi in different forms, particularly Kali in Bengal, Durga, and other forms. And this Puranic material, if you like, these stories are established during the Gupta rule, which is 320 to 500. Of 600 CE. And they're concerned with five topics: creation, destruction, genealogies of kings, the reigns of these culture heroes called the Manus, and the history of the Solar and Lunar dynasties. Now, this is all what we would call mythology. Now, and there was never that distinction between mythos and logos, story and reason, that was made by the Greeks. So that's possibly accounts for the lack of historiography. Now, this one group who were important and who composed the Puranas were the Smartas, those who followed the Smritis, the smarter Brahmins. And they were especially concerned with the domestic worship of five gods in five shrines, to bring it all together, Panchayatana Puja, Vishnu, Shiva, Ganesh, the elephant-headed god, Surya, the sun, and Devi, the goddess. But you also get Smartas who are Shaivas and Vaishnavas as well, not necessarily concerned with these five gods. And later, the worship of distinct deities came to the fore. So this is the kind of the background, if you like, of the religions. Now, with the collapse of the Gupta Empire, you get the rise of independent kingdoms. And in the 7th century, you get the Chalukyas in the central and western Deccan, the Pallavas in the southeast. From about 900 to 1200, these kingdoms are replaced by the Pandyas in the far south, the Cholas, particularly important in the Tamil region, and the Rashtrakutas replacing the Chalukyas. Now, each of these kingdoms developed urban centres with big temples, and there were administrative centres as well as ritual centres. And all of the religions were had various degrees of success in these different kingdoms. So some kings were very tolerant towards Jainism and Buddhism and Shaivism, and some were less so. And it's during this period that you get the Vishnu, Shiva and Devi rising in great importance because of the temple cities. There are these big temples, regional temples, with focus on one of these gods from the 11th to 13th centuries. And for example, we get Jagannath, where we get the word juggernaut from, Jagannath, the lord of the universe. Chidambaram, sky of consciousness, which is in Tamil Nadu, and Tanjavur, these large temple complexes, which are wonderful places to visit. Do a temple tour of South India one day. And the earliest, Mahabalipuram, which I think is about 6th, 7th century, I can't remember the date, which is cut out of rock. The original architecture in India is the earliest, a rock temple, the Buddhist rock temples at Ajanta and Elephanta, which are carved out of the rock. And this is carved out of the rock. I've always thought it was slightly odd, but apparently it is, because there's no other... kind of, it's not on mountainous, it's on the beach, you know.
Yeah,
so
it's on the beach.
It's on the beach. So it's strange.
There are 100 temples.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you've been there. But it must be it must have been a rock, you know.
Is it carved out of one rock?
Yeah, it was carved out of one rock. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a big rock called the Krishna Bhattabhum.
Oh, right. So just yeah, it's true, but I've always thought it's strange. I mean, actually it copies the it copies the rock cut temples. Then, if the rock cut the temple in Elephanta and Ajanta, there were caves carved out of the rock. I mean, these wonderful temples and Buddhist monastic institutions. And so it's copying that, isn't it? It must have been that was the skill that they had at that time. They must have presumably had buildings before that made of wood. But anyway, they're the earliest ones. And then the things like by the medieval period, this is the Padmanabha Swami temple in Thiruvananthapuram, which is Trivandrum in Kerala. And that's the Gopuram. They develop these big Gopurams, these big gateways, with lots of depictions of Hindu mythology. This is to Vishnu, of course, the lord of the navel, the lotus in the navel. This is Tanjavur, the Brihadishvara temple, built by Rajaraja the First, Chola kings, and consecrated in 1011. And that's one of the Gopurams there. And if you pay some money, you can get a coconut from an elephant to make an offering. And these. Inside the temple, they have these figures that are protectors of the temple, the guardians. And here we get Nandin. Nandin was originally this ferocious kind of guardian of the temple gates, and he becomes a kind of docile, placid bull in later Hinduism, you know, the the Vahana of Shiva, the bull. But originally he's a fanged guardian protecting the site. Oh, I don't know. Anyway, this is the Shiva Linga in the Tanjavur temple. Massive Linga from the 13th century, from 1011, from the 12th century. Still used, the Brahmin priest there, still worshipping. So all these temples to Shiva have Shiva Lingas. This is the Rajarajeshwara temple at Tanjore again, which is 1003 to 1010, Rajaraja the first. And that's the linga was inside that temple. And this is a lovely place. This is the Gangaikonda Cholapuram, from Rajendra the first, who was the Chola who brought the Puram, the city of the Chola, who brought the Ganges. So he brought some Ganges of water down, and that made the place holy. So it's a bit like Julius Lippmann's got this thesis of polycentrism. Hinduism is polycentric. This is a good example of that polycentrism. You know, you get a bit of the Ganges, bring it down, and then that's the centre of Hinduism. And here's Dwarapalas, Ananta and Nandin. Ananta is an important god in later Shaivism. He becomes the god who creates the universe for Shiva. And there's Gangaikonda Cholapuram. There's different forms of Shiva on the side of that temple. He's half male, half female, half goddess, half god, and the dancing Shiva there, dancing on the Apasmara, the dwarf. And this is Chidambaram, a very important Shaiva Siddhanta centre in South India. A great big tank there, big gopurams, and in the temple, which is just there, you get the very famous dancing Shiva. It's the only place in India where you have a dancing Shiva.
And the same as Nataraja.
Yeah, Nataraja. There, yeah.
Okay.
There he is, there's a Nataraja. And these gods were worshipped with dance, so you get this is Chidambaram, there's 108 dancers on one of the pillars here. And another wonderful place, Darasuran, the Aryavarteshvara temple, the temple to the Indra's elephant. This is Rajaraja the second. Slightly later than these other, the ones we've just seen. There you just get a sense of the place. And lots of sculptures like acrobats and dancers here depicting the kind of activity that would have been taking place in these temples. There would have been very colourful places, very lively places, lots of dancing and singing. Now, the Shaiva traditions, there's Orthodox worship of Shiva in places like that, that we've just seen, those temples. And an Orthodox Brahmin believed that he went to Shiva's heaven at death. So these Smartas and the Puranika kind of Hinduism that worshipped in these temples, the world, the cosmos is like an egg with Shiva's world at the top, and when you die, you go to the top of the egg, Shiva Loka. And the Shaiva is a follower of the teachings of Shiva, contained in the Shaiva scriptures, particularly the Tantras. And these Shaivas revered a group of texts called the Tantras or Agamas, and we'll be looking at that next week, not today. Now today, the main Shaiva sect mentioned in this text called the Skanda Purana are the Pashupatas. And this is who I want to look at mostly today. And there's a text called the Pashupata Sutras, which is probably about the 2nd, 3rd century, and a commentary by Kaundinya, who's 4th to 6th century, possibly. Now, these texts, the Pashupatas, Pashupati is a name for Shiva, the lord of the beasts, of the creatures, which are the souls. And this was an important sect of Shaivism in the medieval period. So you've got main Puranic Shaivism worshipping in the big temples with patronage from the kings and so on, and then you've got sects developing, particularly the Pashupatas, become important in later Hinduism. And it's based on a myth of Lakulisha, the lord of the club. Now, this text is said to be a revelation of Rudra, who became Lakulisha by entering and reanimating the corpse of a Brahmin. So it's kind of proto-tantric here. And in this form, he gave the teachings of the Pashupata Sutra. So Shiva, Rudra, enters the dead body of a Brahmin, brings it back to life, and teaches. He becomes an avatara, an incarnation of Shiva, teaching the teachings of the Pashupata Sutras. And this group thought they had the fifth ashrama. You remember the four ashramas of student, householder, hermit, and renouncer? Well, they said they had the fifth ashrama, i.e. going beyond, transcending the Vedic structure. And this was the perfected state, the Siddha ashrama. And it was also called the higher or the outer path, the Atimurga.
Sorry, are the ashramas related to the ashtas exactly or not?
So the what?
The four girls, the four.
Oh, no.
Are they related?
No.
Sorry.
No. The Purusharthas are the four purposes of life.
Yes.
Which is Dharma.
You mentioned householder and Dharma. Yes.
Yeah, but these are the four stages of life. I don't think they map. They don't really map on.
I see. I just wonder if they map slightly with end stages.
Possibly some people have done that.
I see.
I don't think they're a different system, really. So the ashramas are the stages of life, yeah. And they said they had the outer path and the higher marga, the ati marga. And their philosophy has five categories, the pancharta. Pancha Arta, the five purposes or five categories. And these are the five categories in this text. Karana, which is the cause, i.e. God. God is the cause of everything. Karya, the effect, which are the souls, the jivas, you and I are. Yoga is the union of the soul with God, with the Lord. Vidhi is injunction of the rules and practices of the tradition, of the sect. And Dukkanta is the end of suffering. So, which is liberation, moksha. We'll return to the counter at the end. Now, these were ascetics, they were celibate, brahmacharya, and they practiced yoga, and they even forbids them talking to women, which is actually a practice still practiced today by some Hindu ascetic. We had Saint Tusha is not here, but from his tradition, there was a monk who came to study here, but wasn't allowed to speak with women. So that was a difficult situation for him. He got his degree, you know. But he was a monk, not a Pashupata monk, but a Swaminarayan monk. But it's obviously still a practice. And the last part of the Skanda Purana is devoted to the Pashupata Yoga, which is the yoga given by Shiva and attained at initiation. So you get initiated and then you get to practice these practices. And there are three stages of the Pashupata practice. One is you live near a Shaiva temple of the kind that we've looked at, Tanjavur and so on, and you wear the marks of a Shaiva ascetic, so you wear the three lines, horizontal lines of a Shaiva ascetic, and you might wear a linga, or you might wear a garland of bones, and you cover yourself in ashes, and you bathe three times a day in ashes. You cover yourself in ashes three times a day. But they're ashes of cow dung from the Pashupatas. They're not cremation ground ash. And that's important, that differentiates them from the later tantric traditions that we see. So they're not polluting themselves. And you worship Shiva with mantra, song, dance, and laughter. And you beg your food. And you develop the virtues such as not stealing, celibacy, and non-violence. It's a fairly standard Shaiva ascetic kind of practice. And then the second stage, which is less, you're stepping out of the box here, out of the norm, you abandon all the external signs of a Shaiva ascetic, and you leave the temple, and you go amongst the ordinary people, and you court dishonor, avamana. You attract abuse and through your antisocial behavior. So you laugh uncontrollably, you howl like a dog, you make lewd gestures to young women, you pretend to be mad, and then people will abuse you, and then you'll have a transfer of merit. You'll get their good karma, and they'll get your bad karma. There'll be a transfer of merit occurs just to do that. Sounds like an Oxford building site. Then after that stage, you finish that stage, you withdraw to a private place and lift from arms, meditate on the mantra Om, and also the five mantras of Shiva, which are non-Vedic mantras, which we get in the later tradition, and the five faces of Shiva. And you withdraw to a cremation ground, living on scraps, and you die reaching union with Shiva Sayujya. So those are the stages. They're a bit like Daniel Ingalls wrote an article on the Pashupatas, comparing them to the Cynics in ancient Greece, who were similarly performed antisocial behaviour in order to attract good fortune to them. Now, there were subsects of the Pashupatas, sub-traditions of particular importance, the Lakunisha Pashupatas, and they imitated their god Rudra. So in imitation of Rudra, they carried a skull-top staff, Kadvanga, a staff with a skull on the top, and a skull begging bowl, and they wore a garland of human bone. And this imitation of Rudra was taken to extreme as one who has taken the great vow, the Mahavrata, for killing a Brahmin. Now, in the laws of Manu, the punishment for killing a Brahmin was you had to carry the Brahmin's skull for 12 years as a punishment and wander around from place to place, as it says in the text. Now, this reflects a myth of Shiva and Brahma, where Brahma is in this myth is attacking his daughter, Uma, if I remember, or Parvati, and Shiva, you know, defends her and cuts off the head of Brahma with his thumbnail, and the head sticks to his hand. And he wanders around, and after a period of time, presumably 12 years, the skull falls from his hand at the Kapalamochana Ghat in Varanasi, and that's why it's a famous pilgrimage centre, because that's where the skull of Brahma fell in that version of the myth. Another version of the myth, Brahma is Daksha, and he's forbidden to enter, to go to the sacrifice that Daksha has arranged. But his daughter, Daksha's daughter, who Shiva has married, is allowed to go, but not the son-in-law. And she is so upset that Sati, her name is, she bursts into flame with her magical power. And Shiva is distraught by this and carries her body, cuts off the head of Daksha with his nail again, and carries her dead body above his head in this wild Tandava dance, destructive dance. And the other gods cut off. Vishnu comes along and cuts off parts of her body, and where they fall, there are pilgrimage centres, like in Assam, in Punjab, and various other places. And Shiva calms down. So that's the myth behind all of this. So these Lakunisha Pashupatas imitate Shiva, imitate Rudra from the myths. And another group are the Kalamukhas, the black-faced ones. I'm not sure why they're called Kalamukhas. And they were particularly important in Karnataka in the 11th to 13th centuries. So you see a kind of slide away. There's from the Pashupatas were said, we transcend the Vedic values, we go beyond them, we reach a higher goal. And these other further versions of the Pashupatas are going becoming more extreme, if you like, away from the Vedic orthodoxy, and indeed courting pollution. And certainly, you know, one of these Pashupatas carrying a Brahmin skull is going to be scary to the Brahmins. They're not going to want to be close to these characters. But these groups became very powerful, and they governed and owned lots of temples in Karnataka and other places, and of particular importance was the temple at Somnath in Gujarat. And Somnath was had vast wealth, and it had a pure gold Shiva Linga, but it was sacked by Mahmud of Ghazni in 1025, who carried off the Shiva Linga, and that was the end of that. And the Pashupatas became a very wealthy order. And as all wealthy orders, as all religious orders become wealthy, they get attacked by kings. And that's what happened to the Pashupatas too. And they get transformed into the Lingayats, who were founded by Basava. Now, it gets stripped of its kind of sectarian, more wild, extreme kind of practices. And the Lingayats wear a linga, Shiva linga, around their neck. And in the 12th century, they had they're famous for the devotional poetry, in Kannada devotional poetry. There's a wonderful book by K.C. Ramanujan called Speaking of Shiva, in which he translates poems of these Lingayats, particularly a woman called Mahadevi Yaka, who writes this wonderful poetry in praise in devotion to Shiva, my lord white as jasmine. Take these husbands who die and feed them to your kitchen fires. My only lord is the lord white as jasmine, she says. It's a wonderful poetry. And this community is still existent in Karnataka. Now the Pashupatas philosophy is fundamentally Shaiva, which affects the later tradition. There are three realities in the universe: the Lord, Pati, the bond, which is the universe, the Pasha, which binds the soul to the world, and the beast, or the soul, the Pashu. So as a cow is bound by a rope, so the soul is bound by the world. And the Lord, and the goal of life is to free yourself from the bonds of the universe, with practice and with grace. Now the Pashupatas, it seemed as there was a bit of mixture of grace and practice. So yoga gets defined as the grace of Shiva in the Pashupata Sutra, as well as a practice. So it seems to sort of extend the meaning of yoga out. And these characters are the precursors of the Karpalikas, the skull-carrying ascetics, who still exist today as the Agora, as the Agoras, or the Agoris. And the Karpalikas carried a skull-top staff. And the difference with the Pashupatas, the Karpalikas cover themselves in the ashes of the cremation ground, thereby polluting themselves, consciously polluting themselves with the pollution of death. And for an Orthodox Brahmin, the Karpalikas were unseeables. If you've heard of untouchables, if the Orthodox smarter Brahmin saw a Karpalika, he had to stare into the sun to purify his eyes, because they were so polluting. Now, the earliest Shaiva Tantra that we have is in the Nishvasa Tattva Sankhita, and that attests to a transition from what's called the Atimarga to the Mantramarga, which I do think I'll speak about right now. Now the Pashupata Sutra, the text contains the details of their practice. So I thought we'd look at this last section here. And where it says the question is, is the end of pain promised to the tested disciple? Tested Parikshita. Developed or something like that, even perceived. The tested disciple or the untested one. And the conclusion is to the tested one, because it is said atta, therefore. Here the term atta is used for the quality of the disciple, because this disciple is born in a country known as Brahmavarta, of a good family and is of keen senses and is possessed of the desire to realize the truth. So this is the ideal Pashupata ascetic. So the word atta is to be read in connection with the meaning. Now, how can that end of pains be attained, or by which means? The answer is Pashupati, i.e. Shiva. The concluding part of the proposition, by the grace of Pashupati. Prasada, the word is used for that, for grace, prasada. Here Pashupati means the lord of Pashus. Here the Pashus are all sentient beings except the emancipated souls, like Sanandana, Sanat Kumara and others in the system. Now those were gurus of the Pashupata system, in the lineage of gurus. And the Pashus are both those who are manifested in the shape of Karya and Karana. That's effect and cause. And those who are not so manifested. Slightly obscure meaning that, I think. Now, leave that for a minute. Now, what is the state of a Pashu? The answer is, want of excellence is bondage. Bondage, bandha, is what is want of excellence. And want of independence, svatantriya. So God is independent, svatantra. But the soul isn't. And its characteristic is the obstruction of the power of the cause. So you obstruct the flow of grace, and that's bondage. It is beginningless. By bondage is meant the imposition of its quality. I guess the quality of bondage. Guna, yeah. If you ask what is the characteristic, the answer is that the Pashus are due to their capacity to be seen and to be enchained. So what makes you a being is you're perceptible and you're chained. So I guess the free beings are not perceptible, so they probably don't have bodies, and they're not chained, therefore. There are the parshas, the bonds. There the parshas are the kalas, the kala power, probably you can translate that as powers, which are the 23 elements of the Samkhya system, the tattvas. The powers of Karya, the effect, and Karana, the cause. He says organism and organs. And these kalas will be mentioned later on. Being enchained, bound and obstructed by those powers, kalas, they, the Pashus, remain dependent on the objects like sound, etc. So the objects of the senses, to be an bound being means to be enchained by the world and to be enchained by the senses. And so it is understood that bondage is want of independence and of excellence. If that be one, free from kalas of karya as effect and karana cause, it can be organ of perception as well. that is one who is free from attachment to world, to the object world, becomes free from egos, Pashutva, no, I don't know. yeah, it says na here. It's very strange. Hence it is said, the scriptures mention the caste of those who, even though withdrawn from the object world, get themselves connected with it again and again. So you get reborn over and over again if you're bound. And the other way of explanation, the Pashus are so-called because they are seen, because though they are all-pervasive and possessed of pure consciousness, they see and realize only the body and not the outside world. And those who are averse to the object world do neither accept nor reject it. I think you need a commentary on the commentary, really, to explain the the meaning of it. And the object world depends upon merit and demerit, manifestation, space-time, guidance, and others. So it is well said that the Pashus are due to seeing and binding, because it has been said, those who are released by the Samkhya Yoga and are the masters of Samkhya Yoga are all remembered as Pashus, beginning with Brahma and ending with the birds. So that's the quote that you've got in the middle of the page. So that's just a flavour of the text. It's slightly obscure, but the idea is that if you're a bound soul, you have access access to the world, and that constitutes your bondage. And the souls who are liberated have ended suffering and are at one with Shiva, who have achieved this Shiva Sayujyam, union with Rudra Sayujyam. So that's the partial patterns. Any questions? It gets worse. We've got the Kapalikas next time.
So later tantric practices aren't quite as radical, really. There are sort of precedents.
Yeah, these are pre-tantric tantricas, And there's this one text, this Nishvasa Sankhita, which represents a transition between the pre-tantric and the tantric.
Because it's like they preserve a very old kind of ritual, because the Rudra was really violent and very powerful also. And so they preserve that Vedic tradition.
Yeah. That's right. Although they say that they're moving away from them, they're the fifth stage, they're still within the Vedic framework. Really.
The aspects of Shiva, I think, the most violent aspects of Shiva are inherited by Rudra.
That's right, Rudra is the most violent aspects of Shiva. Yeah. So they adapt that practice, or that image of Shiva, who they try to imitate. What is interesting about them is this antisocial behaviour as part of their sadhana, part of their practice. And yet they're also the most orthodox of orthodox in a sense, because they became, they were very powerful landowners and so on. They owned lots of temples and so much, and got patronage from kings. But where are they now?
How did they get so rich?
They farmed land.
They rented the land.
Yeah, they owned the land. We're given to them by kings, and they got patronage from the kings, and also initiations. I think I'm not sure about that, but I think they charged a lot of money for initiations. I remember Dakshina. So they're mentioned by, I should also say that they're mentioned by Shankara, and Ramanuja refers to the Pashupatas and the different groups of the Pashupatas. So they were obviously quite an important presence at the time but still within the Orthodox fold, really. And revered as ascetics. Except the ship during that middle phase where you go out and court Avamana dishonour. So next time we'll be looking at the tantric traditions, the Shaiva Siddhanta and the what's called Kashmiri Shaivism, the non-Siddhanta traditions. And then after that we'll bring it up, we'll be looking at folk Hinduism and then modern Hinduism, and then that's it. So we'll finish a bit early today. We've got nothing else to say, really.
It's interesting that, you know, that Shiva is represented as both man and woman.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, a lot of these practices are forbidden to women. And
that's right.
Is there an explanation for that?
Yes. And yeah, a lot of these practices, like the Pashupata ascetics, it's just for male ascetics, that's right.
Yeah.
And what is the explanation of that?
So is there anything about sort of embracing the feminine in your practice, or is it
not for the Pashupatas, no. But there was, you get that in Vaishnavism particularly, in the Vaishnava traditions, where Radha becomes a focus of worship, and Krishna and Radha together.
Yeah.
In Chaitanya, so you get the Radha Vallabhis who dress as gopis, dress as women, imitation of the gopis, because all souls are female and the only male is Krishna. So that's a feminized religion in a sense.
Yeah.
But the Pashupatas, they didn't acknowledge that side of Shiva, really,
yeah.
That half of Shiva. They just acknowledged the other half. Yeah, but the when it gets transformed into the Lingayats come out of the Pashupata religion, as far as we know, and they had women that had very important women. Mahadevi Yakub was a particularly important figure in that tradition, and she wrote this wonderful poetry.
Is it the Yoni Linga or just the Linga?
In the Pashupatas, I think it's just the Linga.
Just the Linga.
I think so. And that was worn around the neck, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it still is amongst the Lingayats, they still wear the linga around the neck. But the Lingayats are interesting because I think they deny rebirth, reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
On the Pashupatas, there's Dan Ingalls' article which you can find fairly easy if you Google. If you look at Alexis Sanderson's web page, and he's got an article called The Shaiva World, in which you can see the sort of history of the Pashupatas. And there's also, if you look at the text, the Sanskrit text of the Pashupatas, edited in the Trivandrum Sanskrit series by Shastri, there's a very good introduction, I think, to the tradition. That was in 1940, published in 1940, but I think it's still a good account of the Pashupata religion. And also, perhaps more important is Peter, the Skanda Purana, a book called Early Shaivism and the Skanda Purana by Peter, I've forgotten his surname, help me out, Leiden. Bishop, Peter Bishop. That's a must-read, because the Pashupatas are his area of expertise. Okay, thank you.